The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And I'm going off on Sunday evening to start a retreat, teach a retreat at Spirit Rock. And then Nona Olivia will come and give the talk. Nona is a longtime Dharma student and kind of partly scholar of Buddhism. She has done a wonderful presentations for us here in the past for Sati Center on women in Buddhism, early women. I don't know what she'll talk about next week, but she'll be our guest. So this evening I'd like to talk about mindfulness of emotions. And I think, you know, emotions are very important for people. And it's well worth paying careful attention to them and becoming a little bit wiser about the ecology of emotions, how emotions come into play. And an important part of mindfulness training, as we teach it here, is to become aware of emotions and to become wisely mindful of our emotional life. So that when I teach the introductory course in mindfulness here, I go through a sequence of instructions. The first 4 weeks have four basic areas. There's mindfulness of breath, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of emotions, and mindfulness of thinking. And separate from that, the Buddha has, in his teachings of mindfulness, has what's called four foundations of mindfulness. And because what I teach is four, and because he says four foundations, sometimes people assume that they're talking about the same thing. But his four foundations are different than what I teach here. The four foundations for the Buddha for mindfulness are it's the body, and within the category of the body includes breath, but other aspects of being in touch with your body. What a thing called feeling tone, vedana, which is the basic raw way in which all experiences we have can be experienced as being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. I'll talk more about that. And then the third category is something that's called mind states. So this is the general state of the mind, general mood of the mind, quality of the mind, that's separate from the particular details of how the mind is functioning. So the mind might be expansive, or your mind might be contracted. The general state of awareness might be very open and clear, or it might be cloudy and dark. So the kind of general states of the mind, that the qualities, the overall character of the consciousness. And then the fourth foundation for the Buddha is what's called dhammas, which are simply can be stated as some of the teachings the Buddha had about how the mind works. But more specifically, it has to do with the particular mental patterns that come into play that either keep us in mental bondage or help us to become free. So, now in terms of mindfulness of emotions, what's interesting is that nowhere in the Buddha's teachings does he give instructions for mindfulness of emotions. And in his four foundations of mindfulness, there is no category in there that fits our category of emotions. You could squeeze out of it a little bit, maybe, and say, well, this refers to emotions here, kind of. But he doesn't actually give instructions on how to pay attention to emotions. So then the question is, is it only us modern people that have emotions, and they didn't have back then, or did the Buddha not, was he kind of like an emotionless person and didn't focus on emotions? It would certainly explain a lot about Buddhism. Or at least some Buddhists. But how I see it is that in the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha is encouraging us to pay attention to primary experiences. And the argument can be made that what we call emotions in English is secondary experience, or constructed experience, constructed out of more primary steps. So what I mean by that is that you can talk about, for example, buildings, and you don't know what a person's talking about because there's many different kinds of buildings. But say buildings are built out of bricks or out of wood. So you can talk about bricks in a very particular way. Most bricks are the same, I guess. And you can talk about how putting bricks together in different ways. So if you want to know about the basic elements that constructs a building, you'd look at the bricks and the mortar and the wood and all that. So the same thing with emotions. Emotions are, for the most part, or to a great degree, constructed out of other elements. And if you want to understand emotions, you want to understand the elements that bring them into play. Now, emotions can often very easily be seen as solid unitary experiences. That emotion is just a solid, I am, I'm feeling angry, thank you, and it's just anger. And it's hard to see that it's made up of different things. Same thing with pain. Pain, physical pain, is often seen as a unitary experience, a singular experience. But in fact, what physiologists of pain, people who study pain, point out is that the experience of pain, while it's experienced as being singular, is made up of many different factors, physical, mental, intentional, many factors that come together, and that and depending how those things come together at their meeting, we have the experience of pain. But if you start changing some of the threads that come together to create pain, if you change some of them, the pain can change quite a bit. And one of the classic examples that people give is, our evaluation around pain can affect how much strongly we feel pain, or our fear that's connected to the pain can influence how strongly we feel the pain. So when there's a big unknown factor, people often feel more fear, and the pain level goes up. Maybe it makes some sense, because part of the function of pain is to be a danger signal. And if you don't know what's going on, you want more danger signal. Better pay attention. But you go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you a diagnosis and said, that's no problem at all, and you feel relieved, and then it's not such a big deal anymore. And you don't feel quite the intensity, because part of the intensity comes from the emotional involvement with it. It's been pointed out that people can have similar kinds of injuries in a car accident on the freeway as they can in a battlefield. And so, for some reason, people on the battlefield often don't feel pain the same way than people in a car accident because of the different kind of mental relationship to the experience. So the same thing with emotions. Emotions also involve the meeting of many different factors. And as we want to try to understand what an emotion is, it's helpful to begin looking more carefully and teasing apart the different elements and not treating them as unitary. Some of the great manifestos, philosophies people have had about emotions that I've seen sometimes here in the West are often focusing on them as kind of, you know, there's one policy about this is what you do with an emotion. I mean, one classic policy has been repression. Well, you know, we should just not have emotions, we should repress them, or certain emotions. Another policy that was popular in the 1970s, 60s, 70s or so, was that of expressive catharsis. And you just get it off your chest, you should yell and scream, pound the pillows, and tell everyone exactly what's on your mind. And it mostly became, you know, sometimes it was helpful for people, especially for the repressed people, to do that. But sometimes, you know, it didn't really help, and it was kind of an annoyance for everybody else. But more importantly, what Buddhism has said for centuries, but now what they found, is that when you repeatedly express some kinds of emotions, like anger, just kind of keep venting it, it might relieve some of the pressure temporarily, but the repeated use of it reinforces the expression of anger. You're more likely to feel it. So rather than helping you become free of it, it actually strengthens the pattern of it. So sometimes the catharsis approach is no longer as popular as it used to be. So there's a kind of, I've known people who seem to be willing to would fight you over their attitude about what you had to do with emotions. Like people have very strong opinions about emotions, some people do. And certain families have very strong lessons that people learn about how how to relate to emotions. You're not supposed to express your emotions, or you are supposed to express your emotions, or there's many things. So so if you look at this, you look at the teachings of the Buddha, and in the ancient language, there's no word for the English word emotions. You can't, it's very hard to translate the word emotions back into Pali, the ancient language the Buddha taught. And there is one word that kind of fits, the word bhava, but it's kind of hard to get it to fit well. So did they not have emotions in the time of the Buddha? Did Buddha not have emotions? No, because you see that particular emotions are mentioned in his teachings. They talk about anger, despair, greed, hatred, joy, happiness, contentment. You know, the whole range of different kinds of emotions are named. But the overall category called emotions doesn't appear there. And so I have one theory of why that is. And the theory is that human experience is made up of many elements, many bricks, many different kinds of bricks, bricks and woods and everything. And imagine taking all the different elements of human experience and making a pie out of it. And then you can divide the pie many different ways. You can divide it, you know, in quarters and fifths and sixths, you know, you can divide in different ways. And you could also make your knife cuts in different parts of where the pie is. So depending on what's on different sides of different parts of the pie, say it's not a homogeneous kind of thing, different things would fall on different sides of the knife cuts, depending on how you cut it. It's still a pie, right? So the human experience the same way, you can divide it up in different ways. And is one way better than the other? I don't know. I mean, is it better to use the metric system than the, you know, the English measuring system? You know, some people have an opinion, but which is truer? Which is the true measuring system? It doesn't make sense to talk about true. It's just different ways of dividing up measurement. And so perhaps in the time of the Buddha, they had a different way of measuring or dividing up human experience. And so the overall category called emotions wasn't there. So I say that to all of you, all this as an introduction, to encourage you maybe to be ready to take a new look at what we in English call emotions and your experience, your relationship, your attitude towards your emotions, and maybe willing to look at it maybe in a new way, fresh way. So if you look at the four foundations of mindfulness that the Buddha taught, one way of seeing them, which is, this is a teaching that I learned from Tanissara Bhikkhu, Tanjeff, who was here a couple of weeks ago, is that these are seen as four different frames of reference with which to look at our experience. So four perspectives from which to look at what's happening to us. And it's good to have different perspectives. Different perspectives help us break through kind of set mindsets, opinions we have, help us see things fresh, maybe in new ways, deeper ways. So, you know, a lot of things are happening to us, and it's helpful sometimes to look at it from the perspective of our body, our embodied physical experience, our sensations in our body, how our body experiences something. Some people live busy lives. They're sometimes very stressed out, and they don't even know they have a body. And finally, they pay attention to their body, and they say, whoa, I need a vacation, or I need to work less, or I need to pay attention to my body here. But it took a while to learn that because they weren't paying attention to it. So it provides a different perspective. We can pay attention to the perspective of the feeling tone. Is it pleasant or unpleasant, the experience? And sometimes that simple question can make a very complex thing much easier to deal with. If what we're trying to do is to figure out how to relate to our experience, how to deal wisely with what's going on, if we see the situation in complex terms, then we could be scratching our head trying to figure out what to do. You go into a crowded room of, crowded of all your relatives and all your former lovers, and they're all together, someone's idea of surprising you, and all your bosses, you can imagine it's a kind of collection of interesting people, and they're all there, And so you could say, what am I supposed to do now? And this is a complicated situation, and I have all this memory and history with these people, and I have these different attitudes to different people, and in fact, I act differently among different people, and now I have to, they're all going to see me in the same room, and it's all very complicated, and you, what do you do? Well, one way to cut through the complication, perhaps, that helps you kind of become a little bit freer from it, a little bit step back and not be so caught in the mix and all, is to say, is this pleasant or unpleasant? And if it's unpleasant, to clearly recognize, oh, this is an unpleasant experience. I've been an unpleasant experience before. What I've learned to do when things are unpleasant, it's best not to, it's best to relax. It's best not to get, you know, pulled in so tightly into the fray. Maybe step back a little bit and go outside and get some fresh air before I come back in. But somehow seeing it as unpleasant, or if it's pleasant, seeing it as pleasant, it can be helpful. So, for example, seeing some things as pleasant, it can be helpful when you're addicted to something. Some people are addicted to computer games, or to watching pornography, or to alcohol or drugs or different things. And one of the things that sometimes happens with these kinds of addictions is the activity is stimulating the pleasure centers in the brain. And the hook that keeps us engaged is the pleasure that's being produced. And we're pushing a button, and we're producing more pleasure and more pleasure, and it's kind of addicting. And so people in computer games find. And so you could, you know, say, what, someone can ask you, why are you so interested in pursuing computer games all the time? And you can lay out an elaborate, complicated philosophy about the tremendous value and sophistication of the games and all the ways in which you're being trained to become a brain surgeon or fighter pilot by using your thumb in a certain way. And to justify what you're doing. But that's, you know, and justify it to yourself even. But really what's happening is you're just going after the simple pleasure that's there. And if you could see that's the case, maybe you can maybe find a little bit more wisdom or freedom from the addictive quality. So what I'm trying to say is sometimes by simplifying the analysis of a situation to seeing whether it's pleasant and unpleasant can cut through a lot of the complications and help us be freer from the situation. It's been pointed out, I don't know if it's always true or universally, but some philosophies of life and even some political philosophies that can be quite sophisticated have their origins in someone not liking something. It was unpleasant. I don't want any more of that. And then they kind of justify that with all this. So, and then the third foundation is the quality of the mind. We could be doing something and be caught up in the details of the thing. And again, like we didn't pay attention to the body, we didn't pay attention to the quality of the mind that we had when we were doing it. One way to kind of get a different perspective, a different frame of reference to what's going on, is to ask, in this situation, what's the quality of my mind? Is it relaxed? Is it open? Is it spacious? Is it stressed? Is it tight? Is it concentrated and focused? Is it scattered and distracted? What's the quality of the mind? And that also can make it things very much simpler and perhaps give a very important piece of information. Because maybe the quality of your mind is more important than a lot of other things. And so safeguarding quality of the mind and seeing that's important can change your choices of what you do in a situation. So the four foundations of mindfulness are four different perspectives that are useful to apply at our experience. So with emotions, we can do this with emotions. We can have an emotion, and then we can say, okay, let's look at it from different perspectives. So the first perspective is to look at the emotion we're having from the perspective of the body. William James, a famous American philosopher, pointed out that from his point of view, you cannot have an emotion unless there's some physical manifestation. You wouldn't know what emotions you were having if it wasn't somehow expressed in the body. You get angry and you get all hot. You get afraid and your stomach goes in knots. or you have butterflies in your belly, or you feel really depressed, and your energy drops out of your body, and your body feels lethargic and tired. There's all these different ways that our emotions kind of play out in the body, with the blood flow, circulation gets affected by emotions, the tensions of muscles get tight and loosened depending on what emotions we're having. We hold our posture in different ways. There's many different things that go on. And so it's possible to notice how an emotion is playing out in a body. One of the reasons why this can be very helpful is that the physical manifestation of emotion is always happening in the present moment. The catalyst and the thinking that might be producing the emotion might have nothing to do with the present moment. So, for example, I could be sitting, meditating, minding my own business, feeling quite peaceful and nice, and then my mind has other thoughts. My mind suddenly remembers 35 years ago, that high school girlfriend. How could she have? You know, and that thought can come like that. And I suddenly feel a surge of fire and energy and tightness. And you just got that phenomenal. And then my mind is just racing right away. I was peacefully minding my own business until that memory came back. The heat and the fire and the energy is here and now. But the story about her, that's the past. She might not even be alive anymore, for all I know. Who knows what she's about? But then I start thinking about it. Oh yeah, that thing that she did, and that was really unfair. And you know, if I had, you know, what I should have done back then is I should have told her, and I should have, you know, this and that. And the more I think about it, it stirs up the energy and the feelings and the emotions. And the emotions are clearly being fueled by the way I'm thinking about it. Now, maybe it's useful to do that sometimes, but you know, if you want to be free and not caught, one helpful way to do that is to drop into the body and feel the emotion in the body. And because the body is not a story. And so it's a way of kind of helping the mind, nudging the mind away from the thinking mind and the repetitive nature of the story-making mind, and come back and feel what's happening here and now. And that can help lessen the way that our thinking is reinforcing and repeating and renewing the emotions. There was an amazing study I read last year or something. Maybe some of you read it, remember it better than me. But some psychologists or scientists were studying how long emotions last, like the lifespan of an emotion. And they claim that emotions don't last more than 7 seconds. Someone read something like that too? It's kind of amazing, right? That's crazy, right? I mean, you know, probably most of you don't see that. Most of your emotions last longer than that. And the claim is that what's happening is where emotion happens, and then we reinforce it, we repeat it, we renew it by how we think about it and are involved in it. So I don't know if that's actually true, the 7 second thing, but the idea, it is true that we often reinforce and renew in ways that we can't often see unless we stop and look more carefully or mindful, notice. So the body can be, so it's fascinating to drop into your body and discover what's going on in the body as you feel an emotion. All the different ways, different days, what goes on in the body. And there are lingering effects in the body. If you have kind of regular chronic emotions, then it takes a chronic effect on the body, and you can have, you know, chronic tension in your shoulders or in your belly or different places. But one of the reasons why it's so helpful to experience emotions in the perspective of the body is that it's as you step out of the thinking of it, you're probably not interfering with it either. You're not reinforcing it or interfering it, and it's easier to let it be, let the emotion be, and let the emotion itself move through you, process through you. I believe that mindfulness meditation is meant to be very respectful of our emotions, where any emotion you have is fine to have while you're meditating. Outside of meditation, you might have to be wise about which emotions you express to your boss. But in meditation, this is a beautiful place where it's safe to let it all come. Murderous rage, let it come. And why it's safe is because you're committed not to move. You can have, you know, the most amazing fiery lust for your best friend's spouse. You know, boy, that's strong. Okay, I guess Buddhism says it's okay. No, it's not, you know, it's not okay to act on it. But just sit there and don't move. Don't act on it. But let it course through you. And as you experience it, a number of things can happen. One is you can learn, if it's a powerful emotion, you can learn to have confidence that you don't have to give in to it. Because emotions, many emotions, come with motivation. Where you have to want to act and do something. And to learn that you can sit still and let it pass through and pass, see the other end of it, is very encouraging. Where you realize you don't have to listen to the tremendous authoritative voice that says, now, something has to happen. The other thing that feeling it in the body and taking time to feel it is that the processing, the movement, the body kind of knows what needs to happen if you don't interfere. And so but feeling an emotion in the body makes space and allows better the flow, the unfolding, the relaxation, the unwinding that needs to happen. The body knows better than you do. If you interfere with an emotion, you can freeze an emotion, and like resentment is frozen anger. You can freeze grief. Charlie Brown only had good grief. He let it, I suppose, you know, he let it flow and whatever. But bad, you know, I guess bad grief would be frozen grief, and plenty of people freeze their grief because of guilt, because of anger, because of many reasons. But if you can relax and feel the grief, feel the anger in the body, don't add to it and don't interfere with it, the body will know what to do. It doesn't necessarily get better right away. Sometimes it gets stronger. But that's part of the process of the healing of the movement that has to happen. So it's going to be very helpful to experience emotions from the perspective of the body. So one of the bricks, one of the building blocks of what an emotion is its bodily sensations and feelings and energy that's here. And so we pay attention to that. The other perspective is this, so the second foundation is pleasant and unpleasant, or most emotions are either one or the other. And so it's a way of simplifying the whole situation around what's going on with the emotion. Is it a pleasant emotion or an unpleasant? And if it's pleasant, are you holding on to it? Are you reaching for it? Are you trying to keep it going? Is there a kind of addiction to it? Are you building a philosophy of life on it? Or is it an unpleasant emotion, and so you're so uncomfortable with unpleasantness that you're trying to push it away, destroy it, and you're reacting to the unpleasantness? Sometimes if simply to feel, oh, this is an unpleasant emotion, and say that to yourself and see it from that point of view, sometimes it's a lot easier to relax and just let it be there in a simple way without being caught by it. So sometimes it's useful. And so the pleasant and unpleasant is one of the building blocks of what we call emotions in English. So then we have the mental state, the mental overall state of the mind. So you can look, when I'm having this emotion, is the mind contracted or is it expansive? Is the mind clear or is it cloudy? Is the mind focused or is it scattered and distracted? What goes on? What's the overall quality of the mind when I'm having this emotion? And emotions come with a certain quality of mind. When there's strong desire, it comes with, they say, with rose-colored glasses. The quality of the mind is such that we tend to see things sometimes, that beautiful person is only being desirable. When there's aversion, we can see things through you know, I don't know what tint it is. What tint is aversion? Desire is rose. So it kind of sets a tone, a mood through which everything is seen. So if you can kind of say, rather than focusing on the overall emotion, if you say, step back and say, what's the quality of my mind while I'm having this? That also can help us step back a little bit and not be caught and entangled with the emotion. And then the fourth foundation the Buddha gives, a different perspective to look at emotions. There's a series of different ways in this last foundation. One of them is a very simple exercise or perspective, and that is, Buddha refers to it as the knot, K-N-O-T, the entanglement, the fetter. So there is an experience that's happening. There's you. And what's the knot? What's the attachment? How have you gotten entangled with that experience? Between you and the experience, what's the knot that has you tied to it? So when there are certain emotions, it's like saying, is there an attachment that's playing itself out when I'm having this emotion? So, you know, if there's strong desire, they're probably attached to something. You're entangled. If there's strong aversion, probably there's some kind of attachment or, you know, negative attachment going on. If there's, you know, fear, is there strong fear? Is there an attachment? This gets very interesting, I think, because most emotions that I think modern people in our society feel are secondary emotions, not primary. And what I mean by that is that a primary emotion would be if a mountain lion jumped in here at this room, I think most of us would feel afraid. You know, some fear and concern would happen kind of pretty quickly. And that'd be pretty primary. And the reason that the example is in my mind is that I'm teaching retreat this week at Hidden Villa. And in fact, when we arrived, they said, oh, there's a mountain lion the last few days that's been eating some of the chickens. So we were told to pay attention, be mindful. So the mountain lion jumps in and it's a primary fear. Worry is considered secondary because worry is an evaluative emotion that comes with evaluation or judgment or a story. So I might sit here in front of you all worrying about the mountain lion coming in because I might not behave Dharma teacher appropriately. And I would be worried that I might not act calm and relaxed or wise, or I might be the first one running out the door. Which, you know, then you would not have a good opinion of me, and your opinion of me is very important. Now we're into a whole other story making and evaluation that's not as primary as the mountain lion itself, right? And so it turns out that for many modern people who live far from mountain lions, most of our emotions have a strong component of being evaluative. There's some evaluation, some assessment, some story making, some belief, some judgment, some interpretation that comes into play for that emotion to be there. And probably all of you, I hope, have had the experience, but maybe I hope not, for my sake, as an example, hope that you've had the experience of having a strong emotional reaction to something that turned out not to exist. And you realize you were interpreting the situation one way, and then you got more information, and it was actually quite different. And you realize your emotion was, you know, it was really an evaluative emotion because it was a story that you made up. So one perspective for looking at your emotions is, what is a story I'm telling myself? What's the evaluation that I'm making? And then, am I entangled with that? Am I caught with it? So the classic thing on retreat, because I'm on retreat this week teaching, I think of this often, is it's pretty common, fairly common for someone to come to me as a teacher on retreat and say, you have to talk to that person, the other person on the retreat. This person comes into the meditation hall late and comes in like a lumberjack, you know, with the boots on, and then sits down and is all winded and takes 5 minutes for the breath to settle down, and it's heavy wheezing. And then, once the breath sits down, rips off the Velcro jacket. And then takes the water container and guzzles the water. And then, after a while, puts the Velcro jacket on again. And you have to do something, because this person is disturbing my precious meditation. What generally happens is that the teachers like me will say, well, why don't you go back and practice with us? And we'll say something very irritating. We say, in our practice, there's no such thing as a distraction. So that's irritating after that kind of problem, right? So, but then you go back, and you have to sit there, and you pay attention. And what happens generally is a few days later, people come back and say, lo and behold, I'm no longer bothered. I paid attention. I noticed that there was a knot, there was a hook for me. I was so attached to my meditation, my progress, my calm, and I was holding on to it, and I felt this person was disturbing my thing that I was attached to. But when I no longer was attached to my meditation, then there was just sound passing through. And it wasn't really that person who was disturbing me. I was disturbing myself by how I reacted to it. And part of that reaction had to do with this whole story I told about I'm on the brink of enlightenment. If it wasn't for lumberjacks, I would be there today. And so sometimes it's very helpful on retreats. We don't design retreats this way and hire actors. but maybe we should. But it's very helpful sometimes to have these kind of people who sometimes are clueless where they are, because it helps people understand, you know, what they're doing. Now, one of the perspectives the Buddha gives for also looking at all our experience, but also emotions now, as I'm saying today, is to look at the experience, the emotion we're having, from a perspective of what is the self-concept that's operating around this emotion? What's the sense of self that's operating? And it turns out that a lot of these evaluative emotions, these secondary emotions that we have, often come together with a particular self-concept that we have, or a self-identity we're holding on to or want to have, some idea we have about ourselves. And so sometimes, for example, the experience, or maybe much of the time, guilt is when the self is bad. Anger maybe is when the self is threatened. Fear is when when the self is hurt. Fear when the self is threatened. Sad maybe when the self is disappointed. Now, let me explain a little bit more, if I may. That might sound fine, but let me give you an example. So I'm there with my little old car at Hidden Villa today, and it's a farm, kind of nature preserve, and has this big dirt parking lot. The wind blows a lot today, and it blows all this dirt on my car. So I might have, let's say that I have a self-concept of a person whose identity is tied to the kind of car I drive. And you really understand what a great Dharma teacher I am, what a great man I am, by the car I drive. And I walked the parking lot, and the car is all dusty and dirty. So now I'm afraid. I'm afraid when I get back on the freeway to drive here, one of you is going to see me in this dusty car, and you are not going to realize what a great person I am. You know? And so I'm afraid of my concept of self kind of being going to be challenged. And so I'm afraid. But then maybe I see one of you, and you see my car. And that ties into all my feelings of being inadequate and not being worthy and not getting, you know, what I deserve in my life, and And I just feel so depressed and discouraged because... And then maybe someone says something. What if you say something in my car? I say, Gil, that's a dirty car. And well, what you don't realize is you just, it said much more than just a dirty car. You said something about me. And so now I'm angry. I'm going to defend myself, show you something. So it's a terrible example, I apologize. But it's ridiculous, right, to have those kinds of feelings, emotions around what I, my identity around a car, right? But maybe it's easy to see that's silly. But often that's the case in some way or other. If you're a parent, how much is your identity, your self-concept tied to how you're seen as a parent? And it isn't so much that your child is bothering you, but rather you're concerned about how you can be seen for how you're parenting. Like the classic thing is, in the supermarket and your two-year-old's having a temper tantrum, everyone's seeing you, you can't cope, you can't change it, you can't help. Nothing you can do for your kid. So maybe take them out and you're holding them and they're screaming and yelling as you leave. And everyone must be thinking that you're a torture, you torture kids. What do they think of me? I think a lot of parents have this. It comes with the territory. And it's not you're a bad parent, it's just parenting is an odd, huh? So one of the perspectives to look at when we have an emotion is, what is a sense of self that's operating? And is there a story, an idea we tell ourselves, and is that sense of self being activated in one way or the other? And is the emotion we're having, how closely connected is it to that self-concept? And chances are you'll find that a lot of times it is. It can be very hard to step away from the self-concept, to see the story or step away from it. And that's why it can be very helpful to drop into the mindfulness of the body and to feel the emotion in the body. It can help us step out of the orbit of the thinking and the story making. It can help us to relax, let things unwind enough until we're calm enough and stable enough that then perhaps we can turn around and look more carefully and more refinedly at what is actually going on here. Oh, there's a threat of my sense of self. There's an idea that I have about what I need, and I'm attached to that. So when the Buddha looks at human experience, I don't think he sees what we in English would call emotion, but he sees these events that we have that are made up of different elements. And part of the task of mindfulness practice is not to just look at things in the conceptual gross picture we have of it, but to look more carefully and see the details or see the elements that make up the experience. And that takes a willingness to look more carefully. Not to settle for the first impressions, but to look again and look more carefully. And in that regard, I like to think of mindfulness as being a very respectful thing to do. Because the Latin word for respect is to look again, respect. And so it's very respectful to stop and look more carefully. What is going on here? And when you stop and look more carefully, chances are you're not as caught in the emotion as when you didn't look carefully. And you can be caught in pleasant emotions just as much as unpleasant emotions. Because if it turned out it had rained at Hidden Villa and cleaned my car beautifully, then when I came to IMC today and all of you saw how beautiful my car is, I would have felt joy and happiness and floating on a cloud. But that joy is not so good either. The fact that you feel joy doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy joy, just like that one. So, thank you, and you're welcome to judge me for my car.